Hello, everybody. Welcome to Microbrew, Milwaukee Brewers Chatter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, and the Milwaukee Brewers, man, they had a great week. What a great week of baseball. They go 5-1 at home. They sweep the Texas Rangers, the reigning World Series champion Texas Rangers. Second year in a row, they've taken all three games from the Rangers, this time at American Family Field. They then take 2 of 3 from the Chicago Cubs. They have hit 5 grand slams in a stretch of, 8 games? We're going to be talking about that, about the crazy power run that they have been on. And they are, again, still 6.5 games up on the St. Louis Cardinals in the National League Central, 16 games above 500, matched for the highest watermark in the season thus far. It is going very well. And unless you're a doom and gloom guy like me who still looks at 2014 as an example, it is looking extremely promising more than halfway through the 2024 season. Todd, I want to start with the power. I want to start specifically with one guy, because Bryce Durang is the guy who hit the grand slam on Sunday. It's his second grand slam in this stretch. He hit one in San Diego in a losing effort, but he hits another one on Sunday. And as great as Bryce Durang has been, there was still a bit of caution in my head about it. You know, like, yes, he's leaned into the hit tool. He has gotten a lot better. His defense is very good. But I always thought we would kind of see him come back to earth. Maybe we still will. I don't know. But at this point, I'm convinced the guy has got to be in the All-Star game at this point. We find out more on the All-Star rosters later this week. He has played so tremendously, and now he's showing power. He's matched his home run total from last year already. You could have given me several names. You could have given me 10 names, and I probably would have picked 9 of them ahead of Bryce Durang as being the guy who really took a leap from last year and really became this level in year 2. Give me your thoughts on Bryce Durang. I mean, he's still not a guy that I think is going to go deep a lot, but he really gets into it when he hits the ball like he did on Sunday and really back the previous Saturday. What have you seen from Bryce Durang this year?
Let's back up. Did you call yourself a doom and gloom guy?
I am a doom and gloom guy. What
does that make me if you're doom and gloom? You're doom and gloom.
I think you should carry around a scythe, wear a hoodie, and just refer to yourself as death. That's correct.
Thank you. That's what I was going for. So
yes.
I learned well from my mentor.
Yes, shouts to Tom Hondricourt.
As far as Bryce Durang goes, I kind of hearkened back to the home opener where I wrote a story basically about his off season and really how he kind of focused on gaining weight, good weight, building strength, and getting stronger. Not necessarily because he saw himself as a home run hitter, but just trying to round himself out a little bit more physically and making himself more of a threat at the plate. I think you're seeing the byproduct of that. I don't think that this Bryce Durang is going to be a 20 home run guy by any means, maybe not even a 15 home run guy, but he's shown the propensity and the ability to be able to take the ball deep. I think his game really has been hitting the gaps with more regularity and using his legs. Obviously he's stealing a lot of bases, but he's just in general hitting the ball with more authority. Looks like he has a much better idea of what he wants to do and what he wants to accomplish at the plate, what pitchers are trying to do to him, and really kind of cut down on the strikeouts and being willing to take his walk. So you're just seeing the natural maturation of a young hitter, and he's throwing the defense as well. And you've got a really well-rounded player. I saw somebody tweet this after the game today. I can't remember who it was. Apologies, but maybe it was you. Was it the Bryce Durang WAR? I mean, he's like top 5 or 6 in the NL in WAR right now, which is crazy. Like 3.4, 3.5. Remarkable, impressive. So, hitting close to 300, really doing it all for the Brewers. So it's going to be interesting to see if he gets any kind of traction, who's going to the All-Star game, who bows out, that sort of thing. But I certainly do think he's got his name at least in the conversation if some chips fall the right way for him.
Who do you think gets credit for this? Obviously the player does, because there was a pretty good adjustment to his swing. and maybe a little bit of an adjustment philosophically what he was trying to do. But, you know, I mean to be a guy like him, you know, to be able to hit 300 is, that's not a philosophical change. Like something shifted dramatically. And we've seen the power kind of, I think, almost a byproduct. You know, the fact that he has 6 homers already this year and had 6 last year. You know, he hit a couple really solidly last year too, but it seems like just being able to strike the ball at just the right spot seems to be translating into some power as well. I think his defense seems to be just as good, if not a little better than last year. Not every defensive metric agrees, but like you said, based on which war you trust, Baseball Reference has him as unquestionably the best player on this team, most valuable anyway, at I think 3.5 wins above replacement. Fangraphs not as bullish, but still a top 5 player on this team. What do you think? Like I said, who gets credit for this? Who do you think really, you know, deserves kudos for transforming Bryce Turang into the player he is now?
Well, I think a lot of the coaches on the staff have played a role in this. You know, you can kind of go around the horn, the hitting coaches, Connor Dawson and Ozzie Timmons, Matt Erickson working with him defensively. You know, I'm sure Ricky Weeks has imparted his wisdom as, you know, former second baseman for the Brewers. And I think last but certainly not least is just Pat Murphy and the belief that he's had in Bryce Turang from the beginning. You know, I can think back to the very first meetings we had with him in spring training, and Pat Murphy just being like overly enthusiastic about Bryce Turang, and keeping in mind the season that he had last year. Of course, us as reporters were, you know, kind of cynical and roll our eyes like, oh yeah, okay, we'll see how this turns out. And lo and behold, he was correct. You know, he predicted and was expecting a major step forward by Bryce Turang, and he's done just that. So I'm sure that Murph has, you know, many times spoken to Bryce about that, and Bryce knows that, you know, Murph is one of his biggest backers and somebody who's in his corner and you know, more than happy to put him out there at second baseman every day. And that has an effect on young players, especially. So you're just seeing the, you know, kind of the byproduct of all these pieces coming together, player putting in the work, player maturing physically, you know, staff working with him and the player taking that all in, a belief in Bryce Turang, and you've got, you know, a really good player as a result. I was thinking today on the way home from the ballpark, you know, we're coming up on the draft here in a few weeks, and 2018, this was a, you know, first round pick of the Brewers, I think 21st overall. And you never really know what you're going to get. Obviously, picking a guy that high, you have really high expectations, and you expect that guy to be in the majors. And you know, he rose through the minor league system. I wouldn't say necessarily quickly, but steadily. You know, basically moving his way through each step and became a little bit better and a little bit better at each stop. Went through a tough freshman campaign in the major leagues, but now is a super sophomore, maybe, as Dick Vitale would say. And looks like the Brewers have a keeper.
Yeah, way below replacement level last year. One of, quite honestly, the number of guys who had his number of plate appearances, he was one of the worst players in the National League in terms of offensive production. And that's just not the case this year. He's going to be a 300, at this point, a 300 hitter or close to it, and a guy who has a little bit of pop in addition to just being able to get on base and steal bases. Second, number two right now in the National League in stolen bases behind Ellie De La Cruz. The Brewers are number two as a team behind the Cincinnati Reds, and it's pretty close. They've really sort of leaned into the running game, and it is turning into, like you said, gold here with Bryce Turang. Another guy who hit one of these grand slams, and this one pretty meaningful, on Friday against the Chicago Cubs in the first of that 3-game series is Jackson Churio. And what we have seen from him in the month of June has been pretty special. He hits the grand slam that accounts for all of the scoring in a 4-2 win over the Cubs. A really exciting game, really just a crazy exciting week for him. He had an inside the park home run on Wednesday in the season series finale against Texas. And then he comes around and hits a grand slam the next game. There's a day off in between, but the next game, you know, we've talked about him a little bit. It's the obvious, kind of the obvious, you know, coming to roost, all the talent, he's making adjustments. He is confident, you know, and you're hearing it from Pat Murphy, who's pretty honest about his player assessment. You know, I think early in the season, I thought he was being a little hard on Jackson Churio. I thought he was, I wouldn't say being unfair, but it was, it was pretty blunt for what I expected to be some growing pains. I think everyone did. But now it's pretty effusive. The praise has been coming in. When you see Jackson Churio, do you, I mean, he's batting fifth now in the lineup. You know, it feels like he's already become one of their key offensive cogs in a lineup that's already pretty good. What are you seeing from him lately?
Yeah, it's another, Bryce Terang maybe, but fast forward, compacted into a freshman campaign here for Jackson Churio. You know, you saw the early hype, hit a few home runs, stole base, you know, like everything, all the major league firsts, falls into this deep canyon, doesn't play for a while. People have written him off. Slowly but surely starts digging his way out. And within the span of, month, 5 weeks or so, all of a sudden, like you mentioned, he's become one of their key cogs. And, routinely he has hit fifth. You know, he's kind of bounced around the lineup a little bit, but more often than not, he's been hitting eighth, ninth. And what a guy to have in the eighth or ninth spot in a lineup, because he brings power, he brings speed. And I think you're just seeing the byproduct of confidence here. You know, he's finally seeing some consistent success. He's kept a positive attitude. He's taken the coaching. He's taken the advice from the older players and the guys who have been kind of mentoring him in the clubhouse. And we're seeing all that come together, and all the tremendous physical tools that the Brewers knew and believed that he had when they gave him that unprecedented contract in the offseason. And you know, look what's happened. He's sniffing, he's among the team leaders in home runs now. He's showing improvement defensively. There's still much more work to do in that area. Particularly coming in on balls, but that stuff will work itself out over time. And I'll be interested to see whenever the cases that they do ultimately decide to move him to center, if they do, if they don't, but that's kind of down the line. But at this point, I'll be the first to admit I had predicted that, really by June, I expected he would have been in the minors at some point because of the struggles and because of the fact that, you know, the Brewers are, you know, still in kind of win now mode. And they'd want to get him regular at bats at Nashville, but how wrong I was. And they've continued to roll him out there most days, and he's played well. So again, we're just a little bit over the halfway point of the season now. Obviously, a lot more games to go, but what we've seen so far certainly has been positive as far as he's concerned.
I think what's so exciting about him is that this is right in line with what we've seen from him in the minors. He'll go through a brief period of struggle, he'll adjust, and he'll move up. Brief period of struggle, adjust, move up. Here in the big leagues, period of struggle and adjusted, and already had a great month of June now. You can't expect that it's going to be linear. You know, there could easily be another valley right around the corner. But if you adjust again from here, like, what does that look like? Is he playing by as all-star caliber by the end of July? Obviously it's easy to dream big, and there's sure to be some setbacks here and there, but truly a special moment to see him hit that grand slam on Friday night. I want to take a step back into the discourse about hits and errors. I was talking about this with Kurt last week, and I want to get your take on this because there was a play. I'm thinking about it. Primarily, I'm going back a couple weeks thinking about his inside the park home run where Joe Adell ran in. This wasn't the inside the park home run, but this was a play that Joe Adell mishandled for the Angels in the corner, and that turned into a double and the two extra bases. Well, essentially a little league home run for Jackson Churio. On Wednesday, he hits the inside the parker where Hill, I think, is the center fielder, Derek Hill for Texas, yep. makes a miscue, should not have tried to dive for the ball. It winds up going to the fence. That, to me, was a clear-cut inside-the-park home run. Then you had a case on Sunday, which led into another grand slam, where Ian Happ just completely misplayed a ball in left field. Very tough left field in the daytime, as Pat Murphy said afterwards. But, you know, to me, that's got to be an error, because otherwise the alternative is that the pitcher gets an earned run out of that. But I also cannot explain to you why I think Joe Adell's error was correct and Derek Hill's non-error is also correct. How do you feel about this stuff? Do you share my view that there should be no errors in baseball and we should just do runs and forget about unearned runs, earned runs? You probably do not. I have a feeling we disagree. But how do you look at those, all those cases, and how you assess what's an error and what's not?
Honestly, I mean, this is going to make you laugh, and it's probably going to make some people roll their eyes a little bit, but that kind of stuff falls in the same category for me as complaining about umpires and balls and strikes. What's the point? I mean, we're not going to change it. It's fun to argue about stuff and, you know, what, I don't agree with that. Look at this, that ball was out of the zone, or that guy clearly touched the ball. I don't care, honestly. And I don't mean to sound dismissive or anything like that, but it's stuff that we can't change. It's stuff that's part of the human element of the game still. You know, it's interesting to talk to scorers sometimes. I'm sure you've talked to Timmy O'Driscoll. He's one of my buddies. And, you know, we talk about scoring all certain plays and things that happen in games and all that. I will say that, you know, what I've read from The Athletic, you know, basically stating that MLB wants more offense. So they're going to rule against errors more often than not. And they've been leaning on scorers to not, you know, give errors in certain circumstances. I don't know that I believe that necessarily, but maybe it's true. But again, it just, to me, it just kind of falls in the category of, we don't have any control over it. It happens. It's the human element of the game. And all we're kind of doing is just basically beating our head against the wall, trying to figure it out. So, you know, the Cheerio inside the Parker this week where Derek Hill dove for the ball, that's as pure as it gets. You know, I was trying to remember the last time the Brewers had an inside the park home run. And I saw the highlight a few days later of Orlando Arcia, that ball had hit kind of the cutout and center, right center, and it just caromed the complete opposite way, rolled along the warning track. And, you know, he could have walked around the bases and scored on that. It's a fun play. It's an exciting play. And especially when you got a really fast guy like Cheerio out there, you know, that was easy for him. He probably could have jogged around the bases almost and got in there, but, you know, just a cool little angle for us to write about that day too, with the Jake Bowers grand slam and then an inside the park in the same game, only the third time in history for the Brewers and first time ever. It was, two different guys on two different plays. So just kind of a cool statistical little quirk.
Yeah, I think it was one of four games in the last 70 years. And I'll talk a little more about this and remember when, but, four times in 70 years where a team had an inside the park home run, a grand slam and a walk-off win because Andrew Monasterio wins that game in the 10th. Those three things together has happened only four times in Major League Baseball history in the last 70 years. So I find that pretty cool. I do think kind of what you're referring to, inside the park home runs, I love them. They're fantastic plays. I do think that the way Major League Baseball players are, it is exceedingly rare for that to happen without either a fielder making a mistake or a weird angle wall, you know, just with the nuances of outfield walls in baseball, in ballparks around baseball. Some of that has to come into play for you to get all the way around the bases untouched. But
yeah, there was one, I can't remember if it was I think it was last year, and I don't remember the play. Oh no, was it Luke Raley when he was on the Rays and it was in San Francisco? He hit a ball that literally like landed on top of the wall and kind of like rolled along the top of the wall. Do you remember that one?
Yeah.
That you don't expect Luke Raley, if I'm correct. I think that was the player, but you don't expect guys like that to do it. But you see those little weird bounces and just kind of weird things that happen. It's just another cool part about baseball where you just, you know, it's almost every day you see something that you've never seen before or that you never expected to see.
Here's another thing about Wednesday that was essentially relegated to a deep subplot because of all the stuff that we're talking about happening, and that's Dallas Keuchel started the game for the Milwaukee Brewers. That is not a name we thought to mention last week on this podcast because he was not in the Brewers organization. The Brewers acquiring Dallas Keuchel from the Seattle Mariners in a minor league deal. Keuchel has been pitching for Seattle. He's, of course, a former American League Cy Young Award winner back in 2015, I think. I don't know if I have my dates wrong there, but been a while, and he is still hanging around. He is not going to dominate guys. He's never thrown the ball all that hard. That really hasn't been part of his story. But, you know, he shows up one day. He makes his Brewer debut the next day. Honestly, kind of like pretty similar to CC Sabathia, former Cy Young winner that they bring in, and he's like on scene starting the game almost within 24 hours of the transaction being announced, which is pretty rare, I think. The results were not the same because Dallas Keuchel got hit around pretty good. Now, the Brewers did come back to win this game. And Pat Murphy said afterwards he really feels like Dallas Keuchel can help them. They are desperate for starting pitching, so they've got to find creative outside-the-box solutions. I do think this was an interesting approach. You know, I would not be encouraged, having seen that first start, that Dallas Keuchel still has stuff left in the tank and still is able to help this team. I think that sounds pretty optimistic from Pat Murphy, but I'd be curious what you think. If you think, yeah, I mean, that was a long day for him, a long couple days. You can explain that away a little bit. How did you see that first appearance from Dallas Keuchel? What do you think is the best case scenario with him going forward?
Very uneven. And I do agree. I mean, you got to cut the guy some slack. He came in, you know, he basically had 24 hours to prepare for that. Brewers desperate for starting pitching. So, you know, you kind of chalk that one up. The Brewers did win the game. Ultimately, that's what matters. But the truth is going to be told here in the next several starts, especially this coming series. He's going to have to pitch in Colorado. Who knows how that all turns out. But yeah, I just called up his statistics here and looking back. So his last, what you would call, I guess, really good season was 2018 in Houston. And then he's bounced from, well, no, actually, I take that back. 2019, I had no recollection of this. He pitched for the Braves. He was 8-8, 3.75 ERA. We'll throw out the 2020 pandemic season. He pitched for the White Sox. 2021, 9-9, 5.28. 2022, 2-9, 9.20. 2023, only pitched 10 games for the Twins, 2-1, 5.97 ERA. 2022, Arizona, 0-2, 9.64. Texas, 2022, 0-2, 12.60. I mean, these are ugly numbers. This is a guy that's getting older. That all just tells me that, you know, the likelihood of this succeeding, probably pretty low, very low, let's be honest. But again, what do the Brewers have to lose? You know, they need pitching. It costs a ton to acquire it, especially good starting pitching, because teams just don't want to get rid of it. So what are your options? You got to kick the tires and you got to try things that are unconventional. You got to try things out of desperation, which I think this kind of is, and just see what happens. And if it doesn't work out, okay, well, we tried, but, you know, we got to move on. So he's a name. People love names, but he's also a name that's, you know, I would say many years removed from the prime of his career. So I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt, both sides. Let him pitch a few times and see what they have. And if it doesn't work out, minimal cost, you move on and you look at the next thing. We have a month until the trade deadline. You start looking at options there and seeing what you can acquire there for an acceptable cost.
Yeah, they really just need to bridge the gap of a month. Oh man, I pulled up. He's made two starts at Coors Field and they are both really, really ugly. He went 5 innings the first time, gave up 6 earned runs, 2 2/3 the second time. He gave up 4 earned runs, 6 walks between the two. It's ugly. Only 2 home runs in his 7 2/3 innings. I guess you could live with that. But like you said, they're trying to see what sticks here. They did this last year with Julio Teheran. Always good to point out that this defense kind of makes everything work. That's sort of been how they've weathered the storm of losing so many starting pitchers, is that kind of, I don't want to say you could throw anybody out there, but you could throw somebody who isn't going to strike guys out and the defense is going to go to work for them.
Dallas Keuchel can throw, a lot of sinkers and get a lot of ground balls. You know, I mean, yeah. We saw what happened when he leaves the ball anywhere close to the strike zone, it's going to get hit long and hard. So certainly, you don't want that if you're a Brewer fan or the Brewers. You don't want that happening in his next start in Coors Field, or it's going to get really ugly really quick.
Yeah, the Rangers battled back very quickly after that grand slam from Jake Bowers gave the Brewers a 4-1 lead. By the end of the next half inning, the Rangers had retaken the lead. Then came the Churio inside the park home run, then the walk-off hit later in the game. So a lot of drama in that one. Keuchel did not last long, but we'll see. We'll see. He'll get another shot. A couple more things before we get to three up, three down. You know, I should point out, I've got an interview coming with Tyler Black. I had a couple guys to choose from. I sat down with Trevor McGill and Tyler Black. McGill, I'm going to push him to next week because Tyler Black, tough day for him. He got sent back down to AAA Nashville. So I want to get that out there, not knowing when he might be back. Yeah, I might have jinxed him. I'm sorry, Tyler Black. I talked to him earlier in the week, and it was really fun. Great conversation. We talked about hockey and his original time in Milwaukee when he was with Wright State in the Horizon League playing at Hank Aaron Field. Those some cold, cold memories. But he gets sent down because Garrett Mitchell is up. Finally, after a very long rehab assignment, Garrett Mitchell should be making his debut with the Brewers at some point in Colorado. They are bringing him back to the big league team. I thought it was an interesting call. You know, it was not obvious who was going to be sent down. I guess, you know, in retrospect, Tyler Black is as good a candidate as anybody. He wasn't getting consistent at-bats, but they now have a surplus of outfielders, specifically guys who can play center field. Sal Frelick, who has, I think, struggled this year, kind of does the same thing Garrett Mitchell does. They're now share, you know, they both have spots on the 25-26 man at this point. What Garrett Mitchell was awesome in his rehab starts in Nashville. He was really hitting the ball very well. He himself had an inside the park home run this last week, I believe, and he's been kind of doing great so far. So how do you think they use him? Is he a starting center fielder? Is he, you know, Blake Perkins is still there? Like, I don't have a clear sense in my mind about who gets used when, if anyone. Like, how do you think this shakes out?
Yeah, I don't even think the Brewers have any clear sense as of now. And when we talked to Murph this morning, Sunday morning, he really said as much. You know, it's going to be, he thinks everybody's going to get playing time, but when and how is the question. I mean, you have really three legitimate center fielders on the roster now with Blake Perkins, Sal Frelick, and Garrett Mitchell. You know, Jackson Churio is going to continue to play corner spot. Does this mean that maybe Christian Yelich gets a few more starts than he normally would at DH to open up another outfield spot and put one of those guys there? I don't know. You know, will we see Sal Frelick on occasion play some third base? I'd be a little skeptical of that. But if Joey Ortiz continues to miss time with his neck, you know, and you're looking at a situation where late in the game, if Sal Frelick's not in the outfield, and you want to sub out Andrew Monasterio for matchup purposes, maybe something like that could happen. But these things tend to work themselves out in the end. You know, you've got injuries are always a possibility, especially with the way this team has been incursed in that category this year. Again, you've got the trade deadline coming up. It's always possible that one of those guys gets moved. Certainly there's a few of those names that we listed. Certainly there would be some teams that would be interested potentially in any of those guys. No, you know, another name in that discussion could be Tyler Black too. So it'll be interesting to see how Pat Murphy kind of gets these guys in the lineup, what kind of matchups will dictate, you know, what he's looking for. You know, you're definitely going to want a guy in Colorado who can cover ground. And, to me, the guys specifically would be, Blake Perkins and Garrett Mitchell in that regard, to play center in Colorado. You know, and maybe Sal Frelick in one of the corner spots. So I don't know. I mean, Kurt will get a good look at that up close. He's on the trip coming up here. But it'll certainly give us more to talk about and to write about in the coming days and weeks.
Yeah, before we get to those granular details from this past week, the Brewers did have a rough week with injuries. And I've maintained that the Brewers are kind of fortunate, you know, even though the starting rotation has been besieged by injuries. You know, they have been kind of fortunate. They were able to dodge a bullet when Rhys Hoskins went out because Jake Bowers happened to be hitting very well at that moment. And even though they really missed Christian Yelich when he went out, they were able to come through that okay. And now Christian Yelich is back to hitting the ball really well. He had a home run on Sunday. He's been really good. But they lose Gary Sanchez, their backup catcher. And by the way, William Contreras, Eric Haas, I don't know, is Eric Haas ever going to get an at-bat with this team? William Contreras has just caught all the innings for the last 5 days, 6 days. So Gary Sanchez, though, now on the injured list, so that hurts their catching depth a little bit. Oliver Dunn, who was sent down, he has a back issue. He was really struggling and had been, again, like was on the path to being optioned before the back flared up, so he's now on the injured list. But the big one was Jared Koenig. He had another great outing on Friday night and then comes away with some forearm tendonitis, which is a very ominous injury. He is one of the great stories of the year. 1.66 ERA. He had it was a really huge outing on Friday. He came up big in a big spot and has been continually coming up big in big spots. He has won the trust of Pat Murphy, very high leverage guy. And losing him really kind of hurts, really burns. Like you can be fine with a backup catcher with Oliver Dunn. They have weathered the starting pitching thing, but Jared Koenig's that's a big one, I think. And I would not have said that before the season because I didn't know Jared Koenig's name before the season, or I maybe knew the name, but I knew nothing about him. I've loved seeing him do what he's been able to do. Is it too much to say that this is a big one because they do have a lot of relievers? How do you feel about the team losing Jared Koenig or any of these guys?
No, I do agree. I mean, Koenig to me is the big one. And he gave for years and years and years, we talked about the dearth of left-handed pitching on Brewers pitching staffs and particularly in the bullpens. And, you know, here you had three really effective left-handers in Jared Koenig, Brian Hudson, and Hobie Milner. You know, they brought up another left-hander, Rob Zastrzyzny. We don't know. We haven't seen him pitch yet, so who knows what he'll do. But, you know, Koenig's a guy that really another scouting success by the Brewers. You know, you wrote a good story about just kind of how he bounced around independent ball, everything. He played in the majors briefly for the A's a couple years ago, was in the Padres system last year. Non-roster invitee in spring training, just kind of one of those depth at Nashville guys. You figure maybe he'll cycle through over the course of a season for the Brewers, but to see him come up and, you know, not just pitch well, but the guy's throwing 98, you know, 97, 98. You're like, what's going on here? Like, where did this come from? And, you know, they use him in the opener role. He does well in that. And all of a sudden he's tied for the team lead in wins. The guy, it's been an incredible story. So we'll see. He's got imaging due on Monday. When we talked to Koenig on Saturday, he was fairly optimistic. He said that it seemed to him like they didn't seem overly concerned about it. And then we talked to Pat Murphy, and he mentioned that, well, now they're looking at the elbow. So elbow to you know, forearm, all that kind of stuff. You know, unfortunately, we've heard and seen this so many times automatically. What does that mean? Tommy John, you know, that's worst case scenario. But, you know, who knows? Maybe just because he's been you know, pitching a heavy workload, that maybe all he needs is some rest, and it really is just kind of barking, as Koenig said. So we'll see again in the coming days. I'm sure we'll get an update on that on Monday from Colorado. But just, you know, stinks for him. It's too bad because he was having a heck of a season, and it's been a heck of a story for a guy who's really kind of fought and battled the odds to get back to the majors.
Yeah, it would be a devastating turn of events for him to see him have this moment, to have made it after all that toil, and to come away with an arm injury would be really, really unfortunate and bad for the Brewers. The Brewers have really made the most out of having Jared Koenig on this team. He's made himself pretty indispensable. Okay, let's move into some of the more granular details. We've talked a lot about it, but we got more that we could share from a pretty eventful week. Here we go. It's 3 up, 3 down. I'm going to start, Todd, on a serious note. There was another pretty big story that popped up Saturday at American Family Field, and that's a crazy situation with an escalator. There's an escalator that sped up between the loge and the terrace level as fans were leaving the game on Saturday. 11 people were injured. It sped up. People were, like, you know, falling on top of each other at the bottom. It seems like everyone dodged a massive bullet, that no one was seriously injured or you know, even potentially killed. They had 6 people had to be hospitalized. The Brewers have sent out a couple releases about the issue. They've reached out to those who were injured. And I think ultimately, again, bullet dodged. It's hard to know without knowing all the full extent of injuries, but very scary situation that they're going to keep that escalator sort of off limits for a couple days or a few days potentially until they can get it inspected and make sure all the repairs are made. But very scary situation, a very big story over the weekend. And again, lucky that it's not worse.
Yeah. We came out of the clubhouse on Saturday and I guess it had just happened and we had no, you know, no idea that anything had gone on, and went up to the press box and started working. And I started getting messages from our news desk asking about it. And I had no idea, didn't know anything about it. And then I started hearing sirens and everything. And then it started making a little bit more sense, but I do agree with you that, you know, thankfully it wasn't any, there were no fatal injuries, and you know, it sounds like everybody will be able to, you know, be healed up and back to normal at some point, which is good. But, you know, this is one of those things where it makes you wonder, you know, again, we heard all this stuff about needing money for the ballpark and all the infrastructure and everything, you know, maybe the escalators are part of that package. And it's something that needs to be addressed along with some of these other behind the scenes things, the heating and cooling and computer systems and all that stuff. So, you know, would not surprise me to see that upgraded as well, but best wishes to all affected for sure.
All right. What do you got? First one for three up, three down.
Christian Yelich, you mentioned him briefly earlier, but earlier this week, he hit a pretty notable milestone, stole his 200th career base. The week after, he hit his 200th career homer. So he becomes the 49th player to have 200 homers, 200 stolen bases, and 300 doubles in his career. That kind of blows my mind. I would have thought there would have been more than that,
yeah,
truthfully. But very, very impressive milestone for him. Fifth active guy to do it, and the second to do it in the same season to get up to that level. Was it Jose Ramirez, I think, yep, did it last year for Cleveland?
That's correct.
So,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, congratulations to, Christian Yelich, pretty heady company. And, now on to the next milestone, whatever that may be. You'll have to look on Mike Vassallo's list, because I'm sure there's something else coming up.
Yeah, he's collected those milestones at about the same pace that they're hitting grand slams, like one right after the other, yeah, after the other. And it has been a very good season for him. He is, you know, which brings me to number two. He's in the mix here for this All-Star voting. Phase two of the All-Star voting takes place early this week. It actually is already over by Wednesday at, I believe it's 11 a.m. Central. William Contreras is a finalist at catcher, and Christian Yelich is one of six finalists at outfield. William Contreras just going up against one other catcher, that being JT Realmuto of the Phillies. So slate gets wiped clean. All the votes that brought them to this point do not count. Contreras did lead National League catchers in voting. Yelich was number two among outfielders. If they hold those spots in the next round of voting, they will both be starting the All-Star game. The Brewers will have multiple All-Star game starters for the first time since 2014. But again, that hinges on a new round of voting. I think both of them are very deserving. Both of them, I think, have really strong cases to be starting. I'd say that NL outfield, there aren't a lot of obvious candidates, so that's part of it. And catcher, I know William Contreras has tailed off, but you know, so has Will Smith from the Dodgers. So I think he is probably the best catcher in the National League still to this point. So those guys have a really good chance. You know, we mentioned Bryce Terang, Brian Hudson, reliever, who is obviously having a sensational year, Joey Ortiz, who we've mentioned. All of those guys have cases as well. I'm gonna guess that by the end of the week you'll see that the Brewers have, you know, three, maybe four All-Stars. But it'll be cool to see two guys start if that is indeed what comes to pass.
Yeah, I was gonna bring up Brian Hudson as a name. You know, I think we talked about him briefly before, and the guy just keeps rolling along. I had a really nice chat with him on Sunday. In advance of the Dodgers series, you know, the revenge series for him, which he's not looking at it like that in any way, shape, or form coming up starting Friday at Dodger Stadium. But again, another scouting success. Brewers pick him up for a song in the offseason from the Dodgers. He had just been DFA'd, granted for a $300 million pitcher. But yeah, certainly the Dodgers are kicking themselves for making that decision. I'm sure there was somebody else on their 40 man that they probably could have punted, but Brewers certainly are happy. And as a little interesting footnote. I was talking to Brian Hudson also about that gigantic sinkhole that swallowed the soccer fields in his hometown of Alton, Illinois. I don't know if you saw that.
Oh, I saw the sinkhole. I didn't realize that was in Alton, Illinois. Oh my gosh.
He lives a mile away from there. And that's actually that same park is where he does his a lot of his throwing in the off season. Baseball fields there too. Yeah. So apparently a lot of rock quarries in the area, and there's like some underground mines and stuff in that area. And they think that's what happened, is one of those tunnels collapsed or something. But if you saw the footage of it, pretty crazy. Like they just did, it was like a year old, like all these really nice synthetic fields that they had for soccer fields. And it's all ruined now. They're going to have to shut that whole park down. But yeah, just kind of a little weird twist. And I've driven us back and forth from St. Louis a number of times doing this job, and had never really noticed it before until driving back in April. And sure enough, right across the border, right across the river, about 15 minutes outside of St. Louis is Alton, Illinois, right off the interstate there. So you see the signs and everything. Oh, okay. That's where Brian Hudson's from.
Yeah, that is interesting. It's a fascinating visual. If you haven't seen it, this giant sinkhole in this very, very nice athletic park in the middle of a soccer field. I think it's like 30 feet deep. It's pretty crazy stuff.
Might even be deeper. Like you see like light poles in it and everything. Like it was pretty gigantic. I don't know how you could fill that in and fix it. You know, like it sounds like they're just going to have to like close the park for good or like do something, you know, like, I don't know how you can go back there and feel safe without more of that stuff happening.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. There's that scene in one of the Batman movies. I think it's the third one, The Dark Knight Rises, where the bad guy Bane blows up the football field. I think it's in Pittsburgh. I think Hines Ward is involved, but it honestly like gives that vibe of just like everything falling in underground. It's crazy stuff. Okay, so for my number three, again, kind of a sobering one, unfortunately. Rob Edwards, former public address announcer for the Milwaukee Brewers, passed away this week. Rob Edwards, he had some health problems toward the end of his tenure as PA guy. Again, public address being the guy who reads the lineups and tells you who's up and gives you the stadium announcements. Long, long career in Milwaukee radio. Tremendous dude. I had the chance to talk to him several times over the years. He was there. He was there for a good chunk of years. You know, Bob Betts, for the old school County Stadium heads, they know that voice as well. He's kind of associated with being the public address voice for the Milwaukee Brewers, and he did that well into his later years. And he passed away. And then Rob Edwards kind of had the Miller Park era. He wasn't the only one, but he was. Certainly, I associate his voice with Miller Park baseball, and unfortunately, he passed away. But a great guy. Glad I got the chance to know him, and has definitely his fingerprints all over Milwaukee media in some capacity.
Yeah, I'll finish off on that note too. I was going to bring that up as well. Condolences to his family and friends. Just tremendous guy, and I was going to also mention the fact that us growing up in the area and everything, you equate voices to your childhood, you know? So like Uke obviously, you know, has called all the games as far back as I can remember, as long as I've been alive. Then it was Bob Betts at County Stadium. That's the only voice that I remember. And then you move along to Rob Edwards for really, you know, all but the last several years until Mark Richards took over. So it just kind of a voice that was synonymous to me with Miller Park / American Family Field, what it is now. And Rob was just a tremendously nice guy, did a terrific job both on the radio and on the mic for the Brewers. So tremendous loss for many people. And again, just wish his family and his friends well.
All right, that'll do it for Three Up, Three Down. Here's a few things we didn't talk about. We didn't spend a lot of time on the Rhys Hoskins Grand Slam on Monday. If you had, you know, what in the aftermath of that, I thought, well, that'll definitely be one of the highlights of the week. And here we barely mention it because so much else happened. But that was an amazing home run. He's been really struggling. He tipped the scales very quickly in the Brewers' favor. I happen to know the kid who caught the ball. I don't know him, but I know one of his friends who's sitting nearby. We noticed him on TV. That kid was just coming over to talk to his buddies and ends up catching this grand slam, making a nice catch But Rhys Hoskins had been scuffling and, you know, really got off the schneid with that grand slam, helping the Brewers beat Texas on Monday night. We did not talk about Devin Williams. He has made some progress in his return. He's on a throwing program right now, trying to get back from that those fractures in his back. He has not pitched this year, but that timetable for late July, it's possible maybe you see him right after the All-Star break. That might still be pretty aggressive, but it sounds like things are going pretty well, that he's on schedule or a little ahead of schedule, and that's obviously something that Brewers fans will love to hear. That bullpen's already pretty good, but you could always use a Devin Williams. The Chicago Cubs had a wild defensive inning on Saturday that Justin Steele, their starting pitcher, wound up screaming in the dugout, and kind of justifiably so. Just a wild series of misplays and foibles that allowed the Brewers to get back into that game. Cubs still won on Saturday, but I think for those who watched, there was some unintentional comedy there. Jacob Mizrowski, he had two really good starts in a row in the minor leagues. Brewers' top prospect at this point. Went 11 and two-thirds innings over two starts, allowed four hits, two walks, 13 strikeouts, no runs. Now he did come back to earth on Sunday a little bit. He allowed three home runs in his outing on Sunday. So unfortunately, going back to tempering enthusiasm, but it's good to see him rounding back into form after he struggled a little bit. And Bill Zito, former Brewers bat boy, 1982 Brewers bat boy, now the general manager of the Florida Panthers that won the Stanley Cup earlier this week. So a Milwaukee native, went to the University School of Milwaukee. He leads the Panthers to their first Stanley Cup in franchise history. They went to the finals last year. Very cool. I talked to Bill Zito last year, just a story that you can still find if you look for it at jsonline.com about sort of his experiences a little bit. And now he's a Stanley Cup champion. All right, that's enough of the present. Let's go back in time a little bit. It is Remember When. All right, so do you know the name Todd? This is not a Brewer, but the name Mike Norris, a pitcher for the Oakland Athletics. Does that name ring a bell at all for you?
Certainly does. Left-hander. Yeah, I used to get his baseball cards a lot when I was a kid.
Nice, nice. I don't know the name well, and I wonder if I would have if he had won the 1980 Cy Young Award. And the reason I'm talking about this is there was a game September 26th, 1980, because we were talking about games with inside the park home runs and grand slams, and, you know, kind of rare to get those two sort of, you know, momentous occasions in one game. Well, this was a moment where you got both at the same time when Ben Ogilvy hit an inside the park grand slam against Oakland in late 1980. He was facing Mike Norris. And the reason I ask this is because I kind of think if this play doesn't happen, or certainly if this game doesn't happen, Mike Norris should win the Cy Young. You could certainly argue he should have won it anyway over Steve Stone of Baltimore that year. It's kind of one of the more egregious, you know, if you look up lists of, you know, miss, I don't know what the term is, the wrong guy won. This one comes up a lot. The Brewers were trailing 7-5 in the ninth inning. There was one out. Brewers loaded the bases, and Ogilvy sliced one away from Dwayne Murphy, the outfielder, who kind of mishandled it. A couple sloppy relays later, the Brewers suddenly had a go-ahead inside the park grand slam. They took a 9-7 lead. Gorman Thomas follows with his own home run. Definitely not inside the park for Gorman. That gave them a 10-7 lead, and the Brewers ended up, of course, winning the game. Gorman said afterwards, "I never hit an inside the park home run. I don't want to. I don't want to put out that effort. I do not blame him." Very relatable stuff. Norris came into the game as kind of one of the favorites to win the AL Cy Young that year, but really he gave up 10 earned runs in this complete game. That was a pretty good chunk of the 80 earned runs he allowed all year. He finished with a 2.53 ERA, but he had come into the game with a 2.26 ERA. So the Brewers really getting to him, and Billy Martin, the manager, kind of leaving him in there to sort of absorb this blow, really kind of skewed his numbers a little bit. Steve Stone of Baltimore had just as many first place votes, but Stone got 100 points overall. Norris was at 91. So it was a really close vote. Steve Stone had the wins. This is back, of course, when wins mattered. He had 25 of them. Norris had 22, but Norris had Stone was not a complete game guy. Norris had 24 complete games. He was a monster, and had more strikeouts than Stone, had fewer walks, even though he'd thrown like 34 more innings. So this game, I feel like maybe could have tipped the scales. I'm not sure. Robin Yount and Cecil Cooper had back-to-back homers in this game. It was obviously a very wild game. Billy Martin did not talk to reporters afterwards. He was quite mad about this whole thing. Norris did have one more start, went another nine innings and allowed three runs. So it wasn't his last start of the year, but we're talking very late stages of the season. The Brewers, actually their first inside the park home run in franchise history, was hit by Roberto Pena 10 years earlier. That was also a grand slam. The two inside the park grand slams This one in 1970, May 30th, 1970 against Detroit. Milwaukee won that game 9-7. And then Ben Ogilvie 10 years later with the Inside the Park Grand Slam. We have not seen another one of those. They're harder to come by in, I think, modern baseball than they were maybe in the 80s and 90s. Maybe just the 70s and 80s, not so much the 90s. But yeah, cool moment for Ben Ogilvie back in time a little bit, back September 26th, 1980. Okay, that's it. Go ahead.
I'm going to jump in here. A couple things about Mike Norris. So, for some reason, I thought he was a lefty. I was reading up on him now. He was a righty. The thing that always stuck out to me was he wore a green glove, which was unusual back in the day.
Okay.
Because it was basically just like tan colored gloves for the most part that guys would use. So he had a green glove. Interesting thing about him, he was really good the year, obviously, that you talked about. By 1983, he had kind of basically worn his arm down so bad, got sent back to the minors, did not pitch again in the majors until 1990.
Whoa.
So from 83 to 90, he made a comeback with the A's as a reliever. So he became the first player, the only player to win at least one game with Oakland in three different decades, 70s, Damn. 80s, and 90s.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
You know, Dallas Keuchel taking a year off seems like a lot, or not a year off, but, you know, didn't pitch in the big leagues as he's working through the minors.
Yeah.
That seems pales in comparison to going a whole six seasons without playing in the big leagues and then coming back. That's wild. I did not realize that.
Crazy.
All right. That's enough for a history lesson for today. Let's finish things with your, with the Todd's take of the week. Here it is, Todd's take of the week.
I don't know how much of a take it is, but I'll give a prediction of the week. More craziness in Colorado. Three games is bad enough for the Brewers, but four games out there? Is it just me, or is it every time the Brewers play there, they have like two just gut-busting losses? You know, some guy that just comes out of nowhere and hits a walk-off home run to beat Josh Hader. Remember that several years ago? Or, you know, a pop-up will get lost in the wind and fall, and that'll be the decisive, hit. Whatever the case is, I'm as bad as the Rockies are. You look at the starting pitching they have lined up for that series and the ERAs and the records, horrible. But for whatever reason, I just have a feeling that the Brewers are going to struggle out there because they always do.
Yeah, that's just, you know, anecdotally, it feels like the season sometimes can pivot for the worse in Colorado. I don't think that's probably, I think that's probably not true. But it feels like when they go to Colorado, bad things happen, and then they continue to happen after that, that everything gets thrown off. There's the one time, I want to say 2019, where the season ended there, and they had a chance to win the division, and I think what you're talking about, just a disastrous, disastrous finish. They still made the playoffs and got to the wild card game, but, like, you know, they could have won the division and skipped the wild card game. So a lot of weird stuff happens there, and they not only have to play four games in Colorado, but then they go to Los Angeles to play three games against, you know, the Dodgers, who are obviously one of the best teams in baseball, but the Brewers are really close to the Dodgers. Like, that's a big matchup, you know, for even like tiebreaker considerations for the end of the year. If you're battling for one of those top two spots in the National League, I don't know if it'll really come into play, but it could. So this is still I don't want to say pretty big week. Every week is big, but like this has some potential here for some, you know, big moments, and the Brewers staying the course will be tough going out to those two very tough places to play. Todd, any last thoughts before I send you away?
My last thoughts are, I'm glad I'm off this week, or at least not at the ballpark. I have work to do, but I need to not be at a ballpark for a week. So I'm looking forward to some downtime, and I'm actually going to be going out to watch at least one UWM basketball practice this week. So
nice.
That'll be fun. Yeah. Changing gears a little bit. Seeing what Bart Lundy has in store, and be on the lookout for some updates from that front and Brian Hudson's story. And we'll see you next week, most likely.
Yes, that sounds good. Kurt Hoag will be out west watching the Brewers play these seven games this week. Thank you for joining us, Todd. Appreciate you, man. We'll talk to you again very soon.
JR, it's always a pleasure.
Indeed. All right, here's my interview with Tyler Black again. He is unfortunately no longer or at least for right now, a member of the Milwaukee Brewers. He got sent down on Sunday, but enjoyed my chat with him and getting to know him a little bit. Very exciting future for this guy. So
jinx.
Yeah, I'm Radcliffe
jinx. Cliff jinx.
I have not jinxed many players this year. I will say that I talked to Brian Hudson and Blake Perkins very early in the year, and they have thrived. So I do not feel bad about this.
I bet you if you talk to him again, that'll be a different story, though.
Maybe. We'll see. Tyler Black will be back. But here's my interview with him. Thanks for tuning in. I'll talk to you later, and we'll be back with you next week. Bye-bye. My guest is Tyler Black, rookie with the Milwaukee Brewers. You've seen him playing first base, DH, and have to start talking about Canada. Love talking about Canada. Doug Melvin and Gord Ash have been introducing Canada to the Brewers for many years now. I'm a little bummed you didn't get to see the Blue Jays when you were here. I imagine you were also a little bit bummed. Tell me about the Canadian baseball scene as you saw it growing up, how you think it compares to the American scene, and just what baseball means I almost said the state of Canada, in the country of Canada.
Yeah, I definitely think it's growing a lot. Every year I feel like there's more Canadian baseball players kind of jumping on the big league scene. A lot of good guys having some good years in the big leagues as well this year. So,
yeah.
Growing up, obviously hockey's the biggest thing sport-wise in Canada. But I think during the summers, baseball is definitely growing. It's usually baseball or soccer for most kids I knew growing up. So, yeah. I think it's definitely on the come up for sure.
I know you played hockey for a while, like I'm sure every Canadian child does. How tough of a decision was that to give that up, I imagine? I mean, your dad being an announcer maybe makes that easier in the eyes of other people, but that's still, I'm sure, a big step for a kid to kind of choose baseball.
Yeah, for me, hockey was kind of my main sport growing up, honestly.
Yeah.
Until about 15, 16, I quit at 16 years old, so... Mm-hmm. I kind of first played baseball to get off the ice in the summer.
Okay, yeah.
All my buddies were playing baseball in the summer, so we kind of just hung around the ball field. And, yeah, that's kind of where I started to love baseball. Obviously, my dad was a broadcaster for the Toronto Blue Jays for a little bit, so that kind of also introduced me to baseball. But, first it was just kind of a game to get off the ice. And, it was a tough decision for sure, but at the end of the day, I kind of looked at it as baseball, like working for baseball wasn't work, it was fun.
Yeah.
So, for me, that kind of took me far.
What were some of the experiences you got to have because your dad was the announcer for the Blue Jays? Did you get to meet players? I mean, can you kind of go through like what that meant to you as you were growing up?
Yeah, I was always at batting practice, which was cool. I always got to see big leaguers at a young age.
Yeah.
And I think that really helped me, just like seeing how guys worked and everything, and how early they get to the park, kind of what the lifestyle's like. I kind of love that at an early age, seeing that. And then there's another component of, he also did other sports too, hockey,
sure,
basketball, and then like seeing great players, man, like seeing Kobe Bryant like 3 hours before a game.
Yeah, that's sweet.
13 years old. Or seeing Kevin Durant, or seeing all these guys, and it's like, wow, like this is what it takes to be like the leader of your craft, and that kind of opened my eyes a little bit.
Yeah. Sure. Did you have? I mean, were you a Blue Jays fan growing up? I imagine so. Did you have guys? Who were your guys growing up?
Yeah, they weren't too good.
Most
of my time growing up, so there's a time Aaron Hill, he was a second baseman. He took me aside one time. I know he played here.
Played for Milwaukee for like 4 months, but yeah 3 months, yeah. Yes.
But he took me aside. My dad was doing the game that day. I'll never forget it. And took me aside, just talked to me all alone. Didn't have to do that. Didn't even talk to my dad before that, and just talked to me about everything when I was like 9 years old.
Sweet.
That was really cool. So he was one of my favorites. And then Josh Donaldson, kind of through my high school
years, right.
Jose Bautista, those teams were really entertaining. So
Josh Donaldson, who was also here, yeah, as you know. So you got to him. Yeah, you got to
I
meet
played
him.
Played with him in Nashville last
sure.
year too. So
how cool was that? That's
sweet. It was really cool for me, honestly.
That's really cool.
Picking his brain a lot too helped me a lot, obviously hitting wise. So.
Yeah. I'm curious how you got to Wright State of all places. You would have had a chance to play in Milwaukee. I think only one time. There weren't a lot of home games in Milwaukee for you guys for whatever reason. But how did you end up there?
Yeah, I didn't really have a lot of offers coming out of out of high school. There's a couple Division I offers from other small schools. I was pretty much going to a junior college. So Wright State saw me the beginning of my senior year of high school. And sweet. Nate Metzger, the recruiting coordinator, saw me. We were playing at Butler University in Indianapolis. And he saw me, and I visited shortly after and just fell in love with the place and committed shortly thereafter. But, you know, they really took a chance on me. Be forever grateful for that. And, you know, I just absolutely love the place and changed my career for sure.
Do you have any Milwaukee memories of that first season when you were here?
I remember we played at the Hank, I think it's called.
It's such a different venue than where you are now, but yes.
And it was so cold.
Yeah.
It was so cold. And I think there was like maybe 15 people in the stands, and they're all parents. And
welcome to Milwaukee.
Yeah, it wasn't a good introduction for sure. I was like, wow.
Yeah.
Hopefully never come here again. It's really cold, but obviously we're here now and in a better venue for sure.
Yeah. Have you ever been approached to do any national baseball stuff with Canada? Like, I know you've been teammates with, well, Rob Destrizny, if I say his name correctly, and then Abraham Toro last year. So those guys got to do some of that with the World Baseball Classic. Have you ever had an opportunity to do any of that?
Yeah, last year I was actually supposed to play for the World Baseball Classic team.
Okay.
I had a couple injuries the year before, and it kind of messed up the insurance on it. I don't know how it worked.
Okay.
It was a technical thing
Sure.
that didn't allow me to play. But going forward, like, I would love to play for Canada for sure.
The automatic strike system that you get in the minor leagues, you very famously seem to have a perfect command of the strike zone. And then I've heard people sort of suggest that it's difficult to adjust when you come up to the big leagues and they don't have that automated strike zone and you have to go, I guess, more by feel. How would you describe that transition? Do you feel it's more difficult because you know you don't have that challenge in your back pocket or even just the full automated system?
Yeah, I mean, I think I don't necessarily think it's a tough adjustment. I've just tried to look at it as it's the same thing. Like,
sure.
At the end of the day, like, if a 1-0 pitch is an inch off the plate or something like that, like, it's not really going to, like, sure, it's going to be 2-0 in AAA. Like, that's a big difference, sure. But at the end of the day, like, I'm just trying to control what I can up there. Like, guys are too good to be swinging at pitches off the black in hitter's counts and everything. So,
yeah.
Like, my approach has always been just trying to swing at pitches I can drive and do damage on until two strikes. Two strikes is a different story. I'm up there battling.
Mm-hmm.
But until then, man, like, I can only control what I can. And, it is kind of an adjustment, maybe. But at the end of the day, like, it really doesn't change much, you know?
Yeah.
Like, maybe you'll get into some better counts. And it is definitely a smaller zone, no doubt, but... Yeah, at the end of the day, I just try to swing pitches I can drive. So,
do you prefer the challenge system to the full-fledged ABS system?
Yes.
You do? I think that's pretty universal at this point.
Yeah, the ABS will get kind of crazy, not going to lie. There are some places where us as a team kind of felt like it was a little different than other places.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Based on where the cameras are.
And I know they've had that issue, but I mean, I do enjoy the challenge system for sure.
How about defensively? Work in progress on first base, but you've gotten a chance to do that here. Outfield potentially in the future? Like, I know you can play just about anywhere. Where are you most comfortable? What do you envision for your future positionally?
Honestly, athletically and ability speaking, like, I feel like I can play any position on the field.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, just a matter of experience and where they want to put me in, you know, the situation. So, first base, I feel really good. Obviously, experienced a lot of ups, a lot of downs. And, you know, that's key. I think I went through that at third base last year for a full year. So, just wherever they put me, I feel like experience is just going to be key.
Yeah. Last question, where is that first hit? You got in your first game, your dad was here. It was so cool. Where is that baseball right now?
I gave it to my mom.
Okay.
It was,
back home.
It was her birthday.
That's right. I remember. Okay.
Yeah, they made it up from Mexico, so...
Do you owe them a Cancun vacation is the next question.
Probably do. probably do, man. I gave it to her. It was a pretty cool night, for sure.
Awesome. Thank you, Tyler Black. Really appreciate your time.